others, but that loss had not hollowed out the world in the same way. Coriolanus still kept his mother's compact in a drawer in his nightstand. In difficult times, when he had trouble falling asleep, he would click it open and inhale the rose scent of the silken cake of powder within. It never failed to calm him with the memory of how it had felt to be loved like that. Bombs and blood. That was how the rebels had killed his mother. He wondered if they had killed Lucy Gray's, too. Just her pearly white bones. She seemed to have no love for District 12, always separating herself from it, saying she was, what was it, Covey? Thanks for stepping up. Sejanus' voice startled him. He had been sitting a few feet back, concealed by one of the boulders, listening to the song. Coriolanus cleared his throat. It was nothing. I doubt any of our other classmates would have helped me, Sejanus pointed out. None of our other classmates have even made an appearance, Coriolanus replied. That already sets us apart. What made you think of feeding the tributes? Sejanus looked down at the empty backpack by his feet. Ever since the reaping, I keep imagining I'm one of them. Coriolanus almost laughed before he realized Sejanus was serious. That seems like an odd pastime. Can't help it. Sejanus' voice dropped so low Coriolanus had to strain to hear it. They read my name. I walk to the stage. Now they've cuffed me. Now they're hitting me for no reason. Now I'm on the train, in the dark, starving, alone, except for the kids I'm supposed to kill. Now I'm on display, with all these strangers bringing their children to stare at me through the bars. The sound of rusty wheels turning drew their attention to the monkey house. A dozen or so bales of hay came bursting out of the chute and rolled into a heap on the cage floor. Look, that must be my bed, said Sejanus. It isn't going to happen to you, Sejanus, Coriolanus told him. It could have, though. Easily. If we weren't so rich now, he said. I would be back in District 2, maybe still in school or maybe in the mines, but definitely in the reaping. You saw my tribute?
He's hard to miss, admitted Coriolanus. I think there's a good chance he'll win.
He was my classmate. You know, before I came here? Back home. His name's Marcus, Sejanus continued. Not a friend exactly, but certainly not an enemy. One day I caught my finger in the door, smashed it good, and he scooped a cup of snow off the windowsill to bring down the swelling. Didn't even ask the teacher, just did it.
Do you think he even remembers you? Said Coriolanus. You were little, and a lot has happened since then.
Oh, he remembers me. The plinths are notorious back home.
Sejanus looked pained.
Notorious and deeply despised.
And now you're his mentor, said Coriolanus.
And now I'm his mentor, Sejanus echoed.
The lights in the monkey house dimmed. A few of the tributes moved about, making nests of hay for the night. Coriolanus spotted Marcus drinking from the spigot, splashing water over his head. When he rose and crossed to the bales of hay, he dwarfed the others. Sejanus gave the backpack a little kick.
He wouldn't take a sandwich from me.
He'd rather go into the game starving than take food from my hand.
That's not your fault, said Coriolanus.
I know, I know.
I'm so blameless, I'm choking on it, said Sejanus. Coriolanus was trying to unravel that thought when a fight broke out in the cage. Two boys had claimed the same bale of hay and had come to blows over it. Marcus intervened, and grabbing each by the collar, tossed them apart like a pair of rag dolls. They flew in the air, traveling several yards before landing in awkward heaps. As they slunk into the shadows, Marcus took the bale for his own bed, unimpressed by the scuffle.
He'll still win, said Coriolanus.
If he'd had any doubts, Marcus's display of superior power had silenced them. He again felt the bitterness of a plinth being granted the mightiest tribute. And he was tired of Sejanus's whining over his father's buying him the victor.
Any one of us would have been happy to get him.
Sejanus brightened a bit.
Really? Then take him.
He's yours.
You're not serious, said Coriolanus. 100%.
Sejanus sprang to his feet. I want you to have him, and I'll take Lucy Gray. It will still be horrible, but at least I don't know her. I know the crowd likes her, but what good will that do her in the arena? There's no way she'll beat him. Trade tributes with me. Win the games. Take the glory. Please, Coriolanus, I would never forget the favor.
For a moment, Coriolanus could taste it. The sweetness of the victory, the cheers of the crowd. If he could make Lucy Gray a favorite, imagine what he could do with a powerhouse like Marcus. And really, what chance did she have? His eyes traveled to Lucy Gray leaning against the bars like a trapped animal. In the shadowy light, her color, her specialness had faded, making her just another drab, bruised creature. Not much of a match for the other girls, even less so for the boys. The idea of her defeating Marcus was laughable, like pitting a songbird against a grizzly bear. His mouth was forming the word done when he stopped. To win with Marcus was no win at all. It took no brains or skill or even particular luck. To win with Lucy Gray would be an incredible long shot, but historic if he pulled it off. Besides, was winning even the point? Or was it to engage the audience? Thanks to him, Lucy Gray was the current star of the games, the most memorable tribute no matter who won. He thought of their hands locked together in the zoo as they took on the world. They were a team. She trusted him. He couldn't imagine telling her he'd dumped her for Marcus, or even worse, telling the audience. In addition, what guarantee did he have that Marcus would respond to him any more than he did to Sejanus? He seemed like just the kind to stonewall the lot of them. And then Coriolanus would look like a fool, begging for a crumb of attention from Marcus while Lucy Gray did pirouettes around Sejanus. There was one more consideration. He had something Sejanus Plinth wanted, and wanted badly. Sejanus had already usurped his position, his inheritance, his clothes, his candy, his sandwiches, and the privilege due a snow. Now he was coming for his apartment, his spot at the university, his very future, and had the gall to be resentful of his good fortune, to reject it, to consider it a punishment even. If having Marcus as a tribute made Sejanus squirm, then good, let him squirm. Lucy Gray was one thing belonging to Coriolanus that he would never, ever get.
Sorry, my friend, he said mildly, but I think I'll keep her.
Chapter 6. Coriolanus relished the disappointment on Sejanus' face, but not for long, because that would have been petty. Look, Sejanus, you may not think so, but this is me doing you a favor. Think about it. What would your father say if he found out you'd traded the tribute he'd lobbied for?
I don't care, said Sejanus, but it didn't sound convincing.
All right, forget about your father. What about the academy? He asked. I doubt trading tributes is allowed. I've already been slapped with one demerit just for meeting Lucy Gray early. What if I tried to trade her? Besides, the poor thing is already attached to me. Dumping her would be like kicking a kitten. I don't think I'd have the heart. I shouldn't have asked. I never even considered I might be making things difficult for you. I'm sorry. It's just...
Sejanus's words began to spill out.
It's just this whole Hunger Games thing is making me crazy. I mean, what are we doing? Putting kids in an arena to kill each other? It feels wrong on so many levels. Animals protect their young, right? And so do we. We try to protect children. It's built into us as human beings. Who really wants to do this? It's unnatural.
It's not pretty, Coriolanus agreed, glancing around.
It's evil. It goes against everything I think is right in the world. I can't be a part of it, especially not with Marcus. I have to get out of it somehow,
Sejanus said, his eyes filling with tears.
His distress made Coriolanus uncomfortable, especially when he valued his own chance to participate so highly.
You could always ask another mentor. I don't think you'd have a problem finding a taker.
No, I'm not handing Marcus over to anyone else. You're the only one I'd trust with him.
Sejanus turned to the cage where the tributes had settled down for the night.
What does it matter anyway? If it's not Marcus, it'll be someone else. It might be easier, but it still won't be right.
He collected his backpack.
I better get home. That's sure to be pleasant.
I don't think you've broken any rules, said Coriolanus.
I've publicly aligned myself with the districts. In my father's eyes, I've broken the only rule that matters.
Sejanus gave him a small smile.
Thanks again, though, for helping me out.
Thank you for the sandwich, said Coriolanus. It was delicious.
I'll tell Ma you said so, said Sejanus. It'll make her night.
Coriolanus's own return home was somewhat marred by the grandmam's disapproval of his picnic with Lucy Gray.
To feed her is one thing, she said. To dine with her suggests that you consider her your equal, but she isn't. There's always been something barbaric about the districts. Your own father used to say those people only drank water because it didn't rain blood. You ignore that at your own peril, Coriolanus.
She's just a girl, grandmam, Tigress said.
She's district, and trust me, that one hasn't been a girl in a long time,
the grandmam replied.
Coriolanus thought uneasily of the tributes on the truck debating whether or not to kill him. They'd certainly demonstrated a taste for his blood. Only Lucy Gray had objected.
Lucy Gray is different, he argued. She took my side in the truck when the others wanted to attack me, and she had my back in the monkey house, too.
The grandmam held her ground.
Would she have bothered if you weren't her mentor? Of course not. She's a wily little thing who began to manipulate you the minute you met. Tread carefully, my boy. That's all I'm saying.
Coriolanus didn't bother arguing, as the grandmam always took the worst view of anything she deemed district. He went straight to bed, dropping with fatigue, but couldn't quiet his mind. He took his mother's powder compact from the drawer of his nightstand and ran his fingers over the rose engraved on the heavy silver case.
Roses are red, love. Violets are blue. Birds in the heavens know I love you.
When he clicked the latch, the lid opened and the floral scent wafted out. In the shadowy light from the corso, his pale blue eyes reflected back from the round, slightly distorted mirror.
Just like your father's,
the grandmam frequently reminded him. He wished he had his mother's eyes instead, but never said so. Maybe it was best to take after his father. His mother had not really been tough enough for this world. He finally drifted off, thinking of her. But it was Lucy Gray, spinning in her rainbow dress, who sang in his dreams. In the morning, Coriolanus awoke to a delicious smell. He went to the kitchen and found that Tigress had been baking since before dawn. He gave her shoulder a squeeze.
Tigress, you need to get more sleep.
I couldn't sleep thinking about what's going on at the zoo, she said. Some of the kids look so young this year. Or maybe I'm just getting older.
It's disturbing to see them locked up in that cage, Coriolanus admitted.
It was disturbing to see you there as well, she said,
pulling on an oven mitt and taking a pan of bread pudding from the oven.
Fabricia told me to throw out the stale bread from the party, but I thought, why waste it?
Hot from the oven, drizzled in corn syrup, bread pudding was one of his favorites. It looks amazing, he told Tigress.
And there's plenty, so you can take a piece to Lucy Gray. She said she liked sweet things, and I doubt there are many left in her future.
Tigress set the pan on the oven with a bang.
Sorry, didn't mean to do that. I don't know what's gotten into me. I wound up tight as a spring.
Coriolanus touched her arm. It's the games. You know I have to do the mentorship, right? If I'm to stand a chance at getting a prize. I need to win that for all of us.
Of course, Corio, of course. And we're so proud of you and how well you're doing.
She cut a large slice of the bread pudding and slid it onto a plate.
Now eat up. You don't want to be late.
At the academy, Coriolanus felt his apprehension melt away as he basked in the response to his recklessness the previous day. With the exception of Livia Cardew,
who made it clear she thought he had cheated and should be dismissed as a mentor immediately, his classmates congratulated him. If his professors were not so openly supportive, he still received several smiles and subtle pats on the back. Sotiria took him aside after homeroom.
"Well done! You've pleased Dr. Gall, and that's won you some points with the faculty. She'll give a good report to President Ravenstill, and that will reflect well on all of us. Only you need to be careful. You were lucky how it played out. What if those brats had attacked you in the cage? The peacekeepers would have been bound to rescue you, and there could have been casualties on both sides. Things might have been quite different if you hadn't landed your little rainbow girl."
"Which is why I turned down Sejanus's offer to trade tributes," he said. Sotiria's mouth dropped open.
"No! Imagine what Strabo Plinth would say if that went public.
Imagine what he owes me if it doesn't." The thought of blackmailing old Strabo Plinth had definite appeal. She laughed.
"Spoken like a snow. Now get to class. We need the rest of your record spotless if you're going to go racking up demerits."
The 24 mentors spent the morning in a seminar led by Professor Crispus Demigloss, their excitable old history professor. The class brainstormed ideas, beyond the addition of mentors, to get people to watch the Hunger Games.
"Show me I haven't been wasting my time with you for 4 years," he said with a titter. "If history teaches you anything, it's how to make the unwilling comply."
Sejanus's hand went up directly.
"Ah, Sejanus?
Before we talk about making people watch, shouldn't we begin with the question of whether or not watching is the right thing to do?" he said.
"Let's stay on topic, please."
Professor Demigloss scanned the room for a more productive answer.
"How do we get people to watch?"
Festus Creed raised his hand. Bigger and burlier than most his age, he'd been one of Coriolanus's inner circle since birth. His family was old capital money. Their fortune, largely in District 7 timber, had taken a hit during the war but had rebounded nicely during the Reconstruction. His scoring the District 4 girl reflected his status quite accurately. High, but not stellar.
"Enlighten us, Festus," said Professor Demigloss.
"Simple. We go straight to the punitive," Festus answered. "Instead of suggesting people watch, make it the law."
"What happens if you don't watch?"
asked Clemencia, not bothering to raise her hand or even look up from her notes. She was popular with both students and faculty, and her niceness excused a lot.
"In the districts, we execute you. In the capital, we make you move to the districts, and if you mess up again next year, then we execute you," Festus said cheerfully.
The class laughed, then began to give it serious thought. How could you enforce it? You couldn't send the peacekeepers door to door. Perhaps some random sampling where you needed to be prepared to answer questions that proved you'd watched the games. And if you hadn't, what would an appropriate punishment be? Not execution or banishment. Those were too extreme. Maybe some loss of privilege in the capital. And a public whipping in the districts? That would make the punishment personal to all.
"The real problem is, it's sickening to watch," said Clemencia. "So people avoid it."
Sejanus jumped in.
"Of course they do. Who wants to watch a group of children kill each other? Only a vicious, twisted person. Human beings may not be perfect, but we're better than that."
"How do you know?"
said Livia snippishly.
"And how does someone from the districts have any idea what we want to watch in the capital? You weren't even here during the war."
Sejanus fell silent, unable to deny it.
"Because most of us are basically decent people," said Lysistrata Vickers,
folding her hands neatly on her notebook. Everything about her was neat. From her carefully braided hair, to her evenly filed nails, to the crisp white cuffs of her uniform blouse setting off her smooth brown skin.
"Most of us don't want to watch other people suffer."
"We watched worse things during the war, and after," Coriolanus reminded her. There had been some bloody stuff broadcast over the airwaves during the dark days, and many a brutal execution after the Treaty of Treason had been signed.
"But we had a real stake in that, Corio,"
said Arachne Crane, giving him a sock on the arm from the seat to his right, always so loud, always socking people.
The crane's apartment faced the snows, and sometimes, even from across the Corso, he could hear her bellowing at night. "We were watching our enemies die. I mean, rebel scum and whatnot. Who cares about these kids, one way or another?"
"Possibly their families," said Sejanus.
"You mean a handful of nobodies in the district? So what?" Arachne boomed. "Why should the rest of us care which one of them wins?"
Livia looked pointedly at Sejanus. "I know I don't."
"I get more excited over a dogfight," admitted Festus, "especially if I'm betting on it."
"So you'd like it if we gave odds on the tributes?" Coriolanus joked. "That would make you tune in?"
"Well, it would certainly liven things up," Festus exclaimed.
A few people chuckled, but then the class went quiet as they mulled over the idea.
"It's gruesome," said Clemencia, twisting her hair around her finger thoughtfully. "Did you mean it for real? You think we should have betting on who wins?"
"Not really," Coriolanus said, then cocked his head. "On the other hand, if it's a success, then absolutely, Clemmy. I want to go down in history as the one who brought gambling to the games." Clemencia shook her head in exasperation. But as he walked to lunch, Coriolanus couldn't help thinking that the idea had some merit. The dining hall cooks were still working with the reaping buffet leftovers, and the creamed ham on toast had to be the high point of the school lunch year. Coriolanus savored every bite. Unlike at the original buffet, when he'd been so distraught over Dean Highbottom's threatening manner that he'd barely tasted a thing. The mentors had been instructed to gather on the balcony of Heavensby Hall after lunch, ahead of their first official meetings with their tributes. Each mentor had been given a brief questionnaire to complete with their assignee, partly as an icebreaker and partly as a matter of record. Very little information had been archived on previous tributes, and this was an effort to correct that. Many of his classmates had difficulty hiding their nerves as they headed over, talking and joking a little too loudly. But Coriolanus had gotten a leg up by meeting Lucy Gray twice already. He felt completely at ease, even eager to see her again, to thank her for the song, to give her Tigress's bread pudding, to strategize over their interview. The chatter died away as the mentors pushed through the swinging balcony doors and caught sight of what awaited them below. All signs of the reaping festivities had been stripped away, leaving the vast hall cold and imposing. 24 small tables flanked with 2 folding chairs each were spread out in orderly rows. Each table bore a sign with a district number, followed by a B or a G, and next to it sat a concrete block with a metal ring on the top. Before the students could discuss the layout, 2 peacekeepers entered and stood guard by the main entrance, and the tributes were brought in single file. The peacekeepers outnumbered them 2-1. But it was unlikely that any of the tributes could make a break for it, given the heavy shackles attached to their wrists and ankles. The tributes were led to the tables corresponding to their district and sex, directed to sit, and then chained to the concrete weights. Some of the tributes drooped in their seats, chins almost on their chests, but the more defiant ones tilted their heads back and surveyed the hall. It was one of the most impressive chambers in the capital. And several mouths gaped open, awed by the grandeur of the marble columns, the arched windows, the vaulted ceiling. Coriolanus thought it must be a marvel to them, compared to the flat, ugly structures that were the signature style in many of the districts. As the tributes' eyes traveled around the room, they eventually made their way to the mentor's balcony, and the 2 groups found themselves locked in one another's gazes for a long, raw moment. When Professor Sickle banged the door behind them, the mentors gave a collective jump.
"Stop eyeballing your tributes and get down there," she ordered. "You only have 15 minutes, so use them wisely. And remember, complete the paperwork for our records as best you can." Coriolanus led the way down the steps that spiraled into the hall. When his eyes met Lucy Gray's, he could tell she'd been looking for him. Seeing her in chains disquieted him. But he gave her a reassuring smile, and some of the worry left her face. Sliding into the seat across from her, he frowned at her shackled hands and gestured to the nearest peacekeeper.
"Excuse me, would it be possible to have these removed?"
The peacekeeper did him the favor of checking with the officer at the door,
but then gave him a sharp shake of the head.
"Thanks for trying, just the same,"
said Lucy Gray. She'd braided back her hair in a pretty fashion, but her face looked sad and tired, and the bruise still marred her cheek. She noticed him looking and touched it.
"Is it hideous?"
"It's just healing," he said.
"We don't have a mirror, so I can only imagine."
She didn't bother to put on her sparkly camera personality for him, and in a way he was glad. Maybe she was beginning to trust him.
"How are you?" he asked. "Sleepy? Scared? Hungry?" said Lucy Gray. "Only a couple people came by the zoo this morning to feed us. I got an apple, which was way more than most, but not exactly filling."
"Well, I can help a bit with that." He pulled Tigress's packet from his book bag. Lucy Gray brightened some and carefully unwrapped the waxed paper to reveal the big square of bread pudding. Suddenly, her eyes filled with tears.
"Oh no, you don't like it?" he exclaimed.
"I can try and bring something else. I can..."
Lucy Gray shook her head. "It's my favorite."
She swallowed hard, broke off a bit, and slipped it between her lips.
"Mine too.
My cousin Tigress made it this morning, so it should be fresh," he said.
"It's perfect. It tastes just like my mama's did. Please tell Tigress I said thank you."
She took another bite, but she was still fighting tears. Coriolanus felt a twinge inside him. He wanted to reach out and touch her face, to tell her that things were going to be all right. But of course they weren't. Not for her. He fumbled in his back pocket for a handkerchief and offered it to her.
"I still have the one from last night."
She reached for her pocket.
"We've got drawers full," he said. "Take it."
Lucy Gray did, dabbing her eyes and wiping her nose. Then she took a deep breath and straightened up.
"So, what's our plan today?"
"I'm supposed to fill out this questionnaire about your background. Do you mind?" He pulled out the single sheet of paper.
"Not a bit. I love talking about myself," she said.
The page began with basic stuff. Name, district address, date of birth, hair and eye colors, height and weight, and any disability. Things got more difficult with family makeup. Both Lucy Gray's parents and her two older siblings were dead.
"Is your whole family gone?" asked Coriolanus. "I have a couple of cousins, and the rest of the covey."
She leaned in to check the paper.
"Is there space for them?"
There wasn't. But there should be, he thought, given how fractured families were by the war. There should be a place for anyone who cared for you at all. In fact, maybe that should be the question to start with. Who cares about you? Or even better, who can you count on? Married? He laughed, then remembered they married young in some of the districts. How did he know? Maybe she had a husband back in 12.
"Why? Are you asking?"
said Lucy Gray seriously. He looked up in surprise.
"Because I think this could work."
Coriolanus felt himself blush a little at her teasing. "I'm pretty sure you could do better."
"Haven't yet."
A flicker of pain crossed her face, but she hid it with a smile.
"I bet you've got sweethearts lined up around the block."
Her flirtation left Coriolanus tongue-tied. "Where were they?" He checked the paper. "Oh yes, her family. Who raised you? After you lost your parents, I mean."
"An old man took us in for a fee. The 6 covey kids who were left. He didn't much raise us, but he didn't mess with us either, so it could have been worse," she said. "Really, I'm grateful. People weren't excited about taking in 6 of us. He died last year of the black lung, but some of us are old enough to manage things now."
They moved on to occupation. At 16, Lucy Gray wasn't old enough for the mines, but she didn't attend school either.
"I make my living entertaining people."
"People pay you to sing and dance?" asked Coriolanus. "I wouldn't think district people could afford that."
"Most can't," she said. "Sometimes they pool their money, and 2 or 3 couples get married the same day and they hire us. Me and the rest of the covey, that is, what's left of us. The peacekeepers let us keep our instruments when they rounded us up.
They're some of our best customers.
Coriolanus remembered how they'd tried not to smile at the reaping, how no one had interfered with her singing and dancing. He made a note of her employment, finishing the form, but he had plenty of questions of his own. Tell me about the covey. What side did you take in the war?
Neither. My people didn't take a side. We're just us.
Something behind him captured her attention.
What's your friend's name again? The one with the sandwiches? I think he's having trouble.
Sejanus? He looked over his shoulder and back through the rows to where Sejanus sat across from Marcus. An untouched meal of roast beef sandwiches and cake languished between them. Sejanus was speaking entreatingly, but Marcus just stared fixedly ahead, his arms crossed, his whole being unresponsive. Around the room, the other tributes were in various stages of engagement. Several had covered their faces and were refusing to communicate. A few were crying. Some warily answered questions, but even they looked hostile.
5 minutes, Professor Sickle announced.
That reminded Coriolanus of another 5 minutes they needed to address.
So, the night before the games begin, we're going to get a 5-minute interview on television in which we can do whatever we want.
I thought you might sing again.
Lucy Gray considered it.
I'm not sure there's a point to it. I mean, when I sang that song at the reaping, that didn't have anything to do with you all here. I didn't plan it. It's just part of a long, sad tale that nobody but me gives a hoot about.
It hit a nerve with people, Coriolanus observed.
And the valley song was, like you told me, maybe a way to get food, she said.
It was beautiful, he said. It made me feel like when my mother... She died when I was 5. It made me remember a song she used to sing to me.
What about your daddy?
She asked.
Lost him too, actually, the same year, Coriolanus told her.
She nodded sympathetically.
So, you're an orphan, like me.
Coriolanus didn't like being called that. Livia had taunted him about his parentless state when he was small, making him feel alone and unwanted when he was neither. Still, there was that emptiness that most other kids didn't really understand. But Lucy Gray did, being an orphan herself.
It could be worse. I have the grandmam, that's my grandmother, and Tigress.
Do you miss your parents? Lucy Gray asked.
Oh, I wasn't that close with my father. My mother, sure. It was still hard to talk about her.
Do you?
A lot. Both of them. Wearing my mama's dress is the only thing keeping me together right now.
She ran her fingers down the ruffles.
It's like she's wrapping her arms around me.
Coriolanus thought of his mother's compact, the scented powder. My mother always smelled like roses, he said, and then felt awkward. He rarely mentioned his mother, even at home. How had the conversation gotten here? Anyway, I think your song moved a lot of people.
That's nice of you to say. Thank you. But it's not really a reason to sing in the interview, she said. If it's the night before, we can rule food out. I've got no reason to win over anybody at that point.
Coriolanus tried hard to think of a reason, but this time her singing would only benefit him.
It's a shame, though, with your voice.
I'll sing you a few bars backstage, she promised.
He would have to work to persuade her, but for the moment, he let it drop. Instead, he let her interview him for a few minutes, answering more questions about his family and how they'd survived the war. He found her easy to tell things to, somehow. Was it because he knew that all he recounted would vanish in the arena in a few days? Lucy Gray seemed in better spirits. There had been no more tears. As they'd shared their stories, a sense of familiarity had begun to grow between them. When the whistle blew to signal the end of the session, she tucked his handkerchief neatly back into the pocket of his book bag and gave his forearm a squeeze of thanks. The mentors headed obediently to the main exit, where Professor Sickle instructed them, "You're to go to the high biology lab for a debriefing." No one questioned her, but in the halls they wondered aloud about the reason. Coriolanus was hoping it meant Dr. Gall would be there.
His neatly completed questionnaire was in stark contrast to the spotty efforts of his classmates, and this could be another moment for him to stand out.
"Mine wouldn't speak, not a word," said Clemencia. "All I've got is what I had after the reaping, his name, Reaper Ash. Can you imagine naming your child Reaper and them ending up in the reaping?"
"There was no reaping when he was born," Lysistrata pointed out. "That's just a farming name."
"I guess that's true," said Clemencia.
"Mine spoke. I almost wish she hadn't," Arachne practically yelled.
"Why? What did she say?"
asked Clemencia.
"Oh, it seems she spends most of her time in District 10 butchering hogs."
Arachne made a gagging motion.
"Ugh, what am I supposed to do with that? I wish I could make up something better."
Suddenly she stopped, causing Coriolanus and Festus to run into her.
"Wait, that's it!"
"Watch it," said Festus, pushing her forward. She ignored him and chattered on, demanding everyone's attention. "I can make up something brilliant. I visited District 10, you know. It's practically my second home."
Before the war, her family had developed luxury hotels and vacation destinations, and Arachne had traveled extensively in Panem. She still bragged about it, even though she'd been as capital-bound as anyone else since the war.
"Anyway, I could come up with something better than the ups and downs of a slaughterhouse."
"You're lucky," said Pliny Harrington.
Everybody called him Pup, to differentiate him from his naval commander father, who watched over the waters off District 4. The commander had tried to mold him into his image, insisting Pup have a crew cut and shine shoes, but his son was a natural slob. He dug a piece of ham out of his braces with his thumbnail and flicked it to the floor.
"At least she isn't afraid of blood."
"Why? Is yours?" asked Arachne.
"No idea. She cried for 15 minutes straight."
Pup grimaced.
"I don't think District 7 prepared her for a hangnail, let alone the games."
"You'd better button your jacket before class," Lysistrata reminded him.
"Oh, right,"
Pup sighed. He worked the top button and it came off in his hand.
"Stupid uniform."
As they filed into the lab, Coriolanus's pleasure at seeing Dr. Gall again was dampened by the sight of Dean Highbottom stationed behind the professor's table, collecting the questionnaires. He ignored Coriolanus, but then he wasn't particularly friendly to anyone else either. He left the talking to the head game maker. Dr. Gall poked at the mutation rabbit until the class had settled in, then greeted them with,
"Hippity hoppity, how did you fare? Did they greet you like friends, or just sit there and stare?"
The students shot confused glances at one another as she retrieved the questionnaires.
"For those of you who don't know, I'm Dr. Gall, the head game maker, and I will be mentoring your mentorships. Let's see what I have to work with, shall we?"
She flipped through the papers, frowned, then pulled one out and held it up before the class.
"This is what you were asked to do. Thank you, Mr. Snow. Now what happened to the rest of you?"
Inside, he glowed. But he maintained a neutral expression. The best move now was to support his classmates. After a long pause, he spoke up.
"I had good luck with my tribute. She's a talker. But most of the kids wouldn't communicate. And even my girl can't see the point of making an effort at the interview."
Sejanus turned to Coriolanus.
"Why should they? What does it get them?
No matter what they do, they'll be thrown into the arena and left to fend for themselves." A murmur of assent came from the room. Dr. Gall peered at Sejanus.
"You're the boy with the sandwiches. Why did you do it?"
Sejanus stiffened and avoided her gaze.
"They were starving. We are going to kill them. Do we have to torture them ahead of time as well?"
"Huh. A rebel sympathizer," said Dr. Gall.
Keeping his eyes on his notebook, Sejanus persisted. "Hardly rebels. Some of them were 2 years old when the war ended. The oldest were 8. And now that the war's over, they're just citizens of Panem, aren't they? Same as us. Isn't that what the anthem says the capital does? You give us light, you reunite. It's supposed to be everyone's government, right?"
"That's the general idea. Go on." Dr. Gall encouraged him.
Well, then it should protect everyone, said Sejanus. That's its number one job, and I don't see how making them fight to the death achieves that.
Obviously, you don't approve of the Hunger Games, said Dr. Gall. That must be hard for a mentor. That must interfere with your assignment.
Sejanus paused for a moment. Then he sat up straight, seeming to steel himself, and looked her in the eye.
Perhaps you should replace me and assign someone more worthy.
There was an audible gasp from the classroom.
Not on your life, boy, Dr. Gall chuckled. Compassion is the key to the games. Empathy, the thing we lack. Right, Casca?
She glanced at Dean Highbottom, but he only fiddled with a pen. Sejanus's face fell, but he didn't argue back. Coriolanus felt he'd ceded the battle, but could not believe he'd given up on the war. He was tougher than he looked, Sejanus Plinth. Imagine throwing a mentorship back in Dr. Gall's face. But the exchange only seemed to invigorate her.
Now, wouldn't it be wonderful if everyone in the audience felt as passionately about the tributes as this young man here? That should be our goal.
No, said Dean Highbottom.
Yes, for them to really get involved, continued Dr. Gall.
She struck her forehead.
You've given me a marvelous idea. A way to let people personally affect the outcome of the games. Suppose we let the audience send the tributes food in the arena. Feed them like your friend here did in the zoo. Would they feel more involved?
Festus perked up. I would if I could bet on the one I was feeding. Just this morning, Coriolanus said maybe we should give odds on the tributes.
Dr. Gall beamed at Coriolanus. Of course he did. All right, then. You all put your heads together and figure it out. Write me a proposal on how this could work, and my team will consider it.
Consider it? Asked Livia. You mean you might actually use our ideas?
Why not, if they have merit?
Dr. Gall tossed the stack of questionnaires onto the table.
What young brains lack in experience, they sometimes make up for in idealism. Nothing seems impossible to them. Old Casca over there came up with the concept for the Hunger Games when he was my student at the university, just a few years older than you are now.
All eyes turned to Dean Highbottom, who addressed Dr. Gall. It was just theoretical.
And so is this. Unless it proves useful,
said Dr. Gall.
I'll expect it on my desk tomorrow morning.
Coriolanus sighed inwardly. Another group project. Another opportunity to compromise his ideas in the name of collaboration. Either have them cut entirely, or worse, watered down until they had lost their bite. The class voted on a committee of three mentors to draw the thing up. Of course, he was elected, and he could hardly decline. Dr. Gall had to leave for a meeting and directed the class to discuss the proposal among themselves. He and Clemencia and Arachne were to convene that evening, but since they all wanted to visit their tributes first, they agreed to meet at 8 o'clock at the zoo. Later, they'd go to the library to write up the proposal. Since lunch had been substantial, he didn't feel deprived by a dinner of yesterday's cabbage soup and a plate of red beans. At least they weren't lima. And when Tigris had scooped the last cupful into an elegant china bowl and garnished it with a few fresh herbs from the roof garden, it didn't look too humble to offer to Lucy Gray. Presentation mattered to her. As for the beans, well, she was starving. Optimism flowed through him as he walked to the zoo. Morning attendance may have been scanty, but now visitors were pouring in so quickly he wasn't sure he'd get a spot up front at the monkey house. His newfound status helped. As people recognized him, they allowed him to pass and even told others to clear a path. He was no common citizen. He was a mentor. He made straight for his corner, only to find the twins, Paolo and Didi Ring, camped out on his rock. The pair embraced their twinship wholeheartedly, sporting identical outfits, hair buns, and sunny personalities. They cleared out without Coriolanus having to ask.
You can take it, Corio,
Didi said as she pulled her brother up from the rock. Sure, we've already fed our tributes, added Paolo.
Hey, sorry you got stuck with the proposal.
Yeah, we voted for Pup, but no one backed us up.
They laughed and ran off into the crowd. Lucy Gray joined him immediately. Even though he wasn't dining with her, she devoured the beans after admiring how fancy they looked. Have you gotten any more food from the crowd? He asked her.
I got an old cheese rind from a lady, and a couple of other kids fought over some bread a man threw in. I can see all kinds of people holding food, but I think they're afraid to get too close, even though they've got these peacekeepers in here with us now.
She pointed to the back wall of the cage, where a quartet of peacekeepers stood guard.
Maybe they'll feel safer now that you're here.
Coriolanus noticed a boy of about 10 hovering in the crowd, holding a boiled potato. He gave him a wink and a wave of the hand. The boy looked up at his father, who nodded approval. He moved up behind Coriolanus, still keeping his distance. Did you bring that potato for Lucy Gray? Coriolanus asked.
Yes, I saved it from dinner. I wanted to eat it, but I wanted to feed her more, he said.
Go on, then, Coriolanus encouraged him. She doesn't bite. Mind you, use your manners. The boy took a shy step in her direction.
Well, hey there, said Lucy Gray. What's your name?
Horace, said the boy. I saved you my potato.
Aren't you sweet? Should I eat it now or save it? She asked.
Now.
The boy gingerly held it out to her. Lucy Gray took the potato as though it were a diamond.
My, that's about the nicest potato I've ever seen.
The boy blushed with pride.
Okay, here I go.
She took a bite, closed her eyes, and almost seemed to swoon.
Nicest tasting, too. Thank you, Horace.
The cameras closed in on them as Lucy Gray received a withered carrot from a little girl and a boiled soup bone from the girl's grandmother. Someone tapped on Coriolanus' shoulder, and he turned to see Pluribus Bell standing there with a small can of milk.
For old time's sake,
he said with a smile as he punched a couple of holes in the lid and passed it to Lucy Gray.
I enjoyed your act at the reaping. Did you write that song yourself?
Some of the more accommodating, or possibly the hungriest, tributes began to station themselves up by the bars. They sat on the ground, held out their hands, ducked their heads, and waited. Here and there, someone, usually a child, would run up and place something in their hands and then jump back. The tributes began to compete for attention, drawing the cameras to the center of the cage. A limber little girl from District 9 did a back handspring after she received a bread roll. The boy from District 7 made a good show of juggling 3 walnuts. The audience rewarded those who would perform with applause and more food. Lucy Gray and Coriolanus resumed their picnic seats and watched the show.
We're a regular circus troupe, we are, she said, as she picked bits of meat off her bone.
None of them can hold a candle to you, said Coriolanus. Mentors who had been avoided before were now approached by their tributes if they offered food. When Sejanus arrived with bags of hard-boiled eggs and wedges of bread, all the tributes ran up to him except Marcus, who made a point of ignoring him entirely. Coriolanus nodded at them. You were right about Sejanus and Marcus. They used to be classmates in District 2.
Well, that's complicated.
At least we don't have to deal with that, she said. Yes, this is complicated enough. He meant it as a joke, but it fell flat. It was complicated enough, and it got more so by the minute. She gave him a wistful smile.
Sure would have been nice to meet you under different circumstances.
Like how? It was a dangerous line of questioning, but he couldn't help himself.
Oh, like... You came to one of my shows and heard me sing, she said. And afterward you came up to chat, and maybe we had a drink and a dance or two.
He could imagine it. Her singing somewhere, like Pluribus's nightclub. Him catching her eye, connecting before they'd ever even met.
and I'd come back the next night.
Like we had all the time in the world, she said.
Their musing was interrupted by a loud, woo-hoo! The tributes from District 6 began a funny dance, and the Ring Twins got some of the audience to clap along in rhythm. After that, things became almost festive. The crowd ventured closer, and a few people began to converse with the captives. On the whole, Coriolanus thought it a good development. It would take more than Lucy Gray to justify the prime-time slot for the interviews. He decided to let the other tributes have their moment and to ask her to sing at closing time. In the meantime, he filled her in on the mentor's discussions that day and stressed what her popularity could mean in the arena, now that there was a possibility that people could send gifts. Secretly, he worried about his resources again. He'd need more affluent viewers who could afford to buy her things. It would look bad if a Snow's tribute received nothing in the arena. Maybe he should make it a provision of the proposal that you couldn't send your own tribute gifts. Otherwise, how could he compete? Certainly not with Sejanus. And there, by the bars, Arachne had laid out a little picnic for her tribute. A fresh loaf of bread, a block of cheese. And were those grapes? How could she afford those? Maybe the travel industry was picking up. He watched as Arachne sliced the cheese with a mother-of-pearl-handled knife. Her tribute, the talkative girl from District 10, squatted right in front of her, eagerly leaning into the bars. Arachne made a thick sandwich but didn't hand it right over. She seemed to be lecturing the girl about something. It was quite a speech. At one point, the girl reached through the bars, and Arachne withdrew the sandwich, drawing a laugh from the audience. She turned and flashed them a grin, shook her finger at her tribute, held out the sandwich again, and then pulled it away a second time, much to the crowd's amusement.
She's playing with fire there, Lucy Gray observed.
Arachne waved to the crowd and then took a bite of the sandwich herself. Coriolanus could see the tribute's face darkening, the muscles tightening in her neck. He could see something else, too. Her fingers sliding down the bar, darting out, circling the handle of the knife. He started to rise, opening his mouth to shout out a warning, but it was too late. In one movement, the tribute yanked Arachne forward and slit her throat.
Chapter 7.
Shrieks came from the audience members nearest to the attack. Arachne's face drained of color as she dropped the sandwich and clawed at her neck. The blood poured down her fingers as the District 10 girl released her and gave her a small shove. Arachne stepped back, turning and reaching out a dripping hand, imploring the audience for help. People were either too stunned or too scared to respond. Many drew away as she fell to her knees and began to bleed out. Coriolanus's initial reaction was to recoil like the others, to grab hold of the Monkey House bars for support, but Lucy Gray hissed, "Help her!" He remembered the cameras streaming live to the Capitol audience. He had no idea what to do for Arachne, but he did not want to be seen cringing and clinging. His terror was a private thing, not meant for public display. He forced his legs into motion and was the first to reach Arachne. She clutched his shirt as the life seeped out of her. "Medic!" he cried as he eased her to the ground. "Is there a doctor? Please, someone help!" He pressed his hand over the wound to stem the blood, but removed it when she made a choking sound. "Come on!" he screamed at the crowd. A couple of peacekeepers were shouldering their way toward him, but much, much too slowly. Coriolanus glanced over in time to see the District 10 girl retrieve the cheese sandwich and take a furious bite before the bullets pierced her body, slamming her into the bars. She slipped into a heap as her blood commingled with Arachne's. Bits of half-chewed food fell from her mouth and floated in the red pool. The crowd surged back as panicked people tried to flee the area. The fading light added a level of desperation. Coriolanus saw one small boy fall and watched his leg being trampled before a woman yanked him from the ground. Others weren't so lucky. Arachne's lips made soundless words that he could not decipher. When her breathing stopped abruptly, he guessed it was pointless to try to resuscitate her. If he forced air into her mouth, wouldn't it only spill out the gaping wound in her neck? Festus was next to him now, and the two friends exchanged helpless looks. Stepping back from Arachne, Coriolanus flinched at the red, shiny stuff coating his hands. He turned and found Lucy Gray huddled against the bars of the cage, her face hidden in her ruffled skirt, her body shaking, and realized he was shaking as well. That's how it was with him. The wash of blood, the whiz of bullets, the screams in the crowd all caused flashbacks to the worst moments of his childhood. Rebel boots pounding through the streets, he and the grandmam pinned down by gunfire, dying bodies twitching around them. His mother on the blood-stained bed. The stampedes during the food riots, the smashed faces, the moaning people. He took immediate steps to mask his terror, cramming his hands into fists at his sides, trying to take slow, deep breaths. Lucy Gray began to vomit, and he turned away to keep his own stomach in check. Medics appeared, lifting Arachne onto a stretcher. Others assessed those who had been wounded by stray bullets or tromped by the feet of the audience. A woman was in his face, asking was he hurt, was this his blood? Once they'd confirmed it wasn't, they gave him a towel to wipe himself with and moved on. As he scrubbed at the blood, he spotted Sejanus kneeling near the dead tribute. He had reached through the bars, and he seemed to be sprinkling a handful of something white over her body while he mumbled some words. Coriolanus only caught a glimpse before a peacekeeper came and pulled Sejanus back. The soldiers were swarming the place now, clearing out the last remnants of the audience and lining up the tributes along the back of the cage with their hands on top of their heads. Calmer, Coriolanus tried to catch Lucy Gray's attention, but her eyes were locked on the ground. A peacekeeper took him by the shoulders and gave him a respectful but firm push toward the exit. He found himself following Festus up to the main path. They stopped at a water fountain and worked a bit more on removing the blood. Neither knew what to say. Arachne hadn't been his favorite person, but she'd always been in his life. They'd played as babies, been at birthday parties, stood on ration lines, attended classes together. She'd been dressed head to toe in black lace at his mother's funeral, and he'd cheered her brother's graduation only last year. As part of the wealthy old guard of the capital, she was family. And you didn't have to like your family. The bond was a given. I couldn't save her, he said. I couldn't stop the blood.
I don't think anyone could have. At least you tried. That's what matters, Festus consoled him.
Clemencia found them, her whole body trembling in distress, and they made their way out of the zoo together.
Come to my place, Festus said, but when they reached his apartment, he suddenly broke into tears.
They saw him onto the elevator and said goodnight. It was not until Coriolanus had walked Clemencia home that they remembered the assignment Dr. Gall had given them, the proposal about sending tributes food in the arena and the option to bet on them.
Surely she won't still expect it, said Clemencia. I couldn't do it tonight. I couldn't possibly think about it. You know, without Arachne.
Coriolanus agreed, but on the way home he thought about Dr. Gall. She would be just the type to penalize them for missing such a deadline, regardless of the circumstances. Maybe he should write something up to be on the safe side. When he'd climbed the 12 flights to the apartment, he found the grandmam in a state, railing at the districts and airing out her best black dress for Arachne's funeral. She flew at him, patting his chest and arms, making sure he was uninjured. Tigris simply wept.
I can't believe Arachne is dead. I just saw her this afternoon at the market buying those grapes.
He comforted them and did his best to reassure them of his safety. It won't happen again. It was like a freak accident, and now the security's bound to be even tighter. When things had calmed down, Coriolanus went to his bedroom, stripped off his blood-stained uniform, and headed to his bathroom. In the near-scalding water of the shower, he scoured the remainder of Arachne's blood from his body. For about a minute,
A painful sobbing made his chest ache, but then it passed, and he wasn't sure if it had to do with sorrow over her death or unhappiness over his own difficulties.
Probably some of both. He pulled on a worn silk robe that had been his father's and decided to take a shot at the proposal. It wasn't as if he would be able to sleep, not with the burbling sounds of Arachne's throat still fresh in his ears. No amount of rose-scented powder could temper that. Losing himself in the assignment helped to calm him, and he preferred working in solitude, not having to parry the thoughts of his classmates diplomatically. Without interference, he created a simple but solid proposal. Reflecting on the classroom discussion with Dr. Gall and the electricity in the audience when they'd fed the starving tributes at the zoo, he focused on the food. For the first time, sponsors would be able to buy items, a piece of bread, a chunk of cheese, to be delivered by drone to a specific tribute. A panel would be established to review the nature and value of each item. A sponsor would have to be a capital citizen in good standing who is not directly related to the games. This ruled out game makers, mentors, peacekeepers assigned to guard the tributes, and any of the aforementioned party's immediate family members. When it came to his idea of betting, he suggested a second panel to create a venue that would allow capital citizens to officially wager on the victor, establish the odds, and oversee the payments to the winners. Proceeds from either program would be funneled toward the costs of the games, making them essentially free for the government of Panem. Coriolanus worked steadily until Friday morning dawned. As the first rays came through his window, he dressed in a clean uniform, tucked his proposal under his arm, and left the apartment as quietly as possible. Dr. Gall wore several hats between her research, military, and academic duties, so he had to venture a guess as to where her desk might be located. Since it was Hunger Games business, he walked to the imposing structure known as the Citadel, which housed the War Department. The peacekeepers on duty had no intention of letting him into the high security zone, but they assured him the pages of the proposal would be placed on her desk. It was the best he could do. As he walked back to the Corso, the screen that had shown only the seal of Panem in the early hours came alive with the events of the previous night. Again and again they aired the tribute slitting Arachne's throat, him arriving to help her, and the gunning down of the murderer. He felt strangely detached from the action, as if all his emotional reserve had been depleted by his brief outburst in the shower. Since his initial reaction to Arachne's death had been somewhat lacking, he was relieved to see that the cameras had only recorded his attempt to save her, the moments when he appeared brave and responsible. You would only notice his shaking if you looked closely for it. He was particularly pleased to catch a quick shot of Livia Cardew flailing her way through the crowd at the sound of the gunfire. In rhetoric class, she'd once attributed his inability to decipher the deeper meaning of a poem to the fact that he was too self-absorbed. The irony coming from Livia, of all people. But actions spoke louder than words. Coriolanus to the rescue. Livia to the nearest exit. By the time he reached home, Tigris and the Grandmam had recovered somewhat from the shock of Arachne's death and were declaring him a national hero, which he waved off but secretly relished. He should have been exhausted, but he felt a nervous energy running through him, and the announcement that the academy would still be holding classes gave him a boost. Being a hero at home had its limitations. He needed a larger audience. After a breakfast of fried potatoes and cold buttermilk, he made his way to the academy with the somberness the occasion demanded. Since he was known to be Arachne's friend and had proven it by trying to save her, he seemed to have been designated chief mourner. In the hallways, condolences came in from every side, along with praise for his actions. Someone suggested that he cared for her like a sister, and although he'd done nothing of the sort, he allowed it. No need to disrespect the dead. As dean of the academy, it should have been Highbottom who led the school-wide assembly, but he did not make an appearance.
Instead, it was Satyria who spoke of Arachne in glowing terms. Her audacity, her outspokenness, her sense of humor. All the things, Coriolanus thought as he dabbed his eyes, that were so annoying about her and had ultimately brought on her death. Professor Sickle took the mic and commended him, and to a lesser extent, Festus, for their response to a fallen comrade in arms. Hippocrata Lunt, the school counselor, invited anyone with grief issues to visit her office, especially if they were having violent impulses toward themselves or others. Satyria came back and announced that Arachne's official funeral would be the following day, and the entire student body would attend to honor her memory. It would be aired live to all of Panem, so they were encouraged to look and behave as befitted the youth of the capital. Then they were allowed to mingle, to remember their friend, and to console one another for her loss. Classes would resume after lunch. After a gloppy fish salad on toast, the mentors were scheduled to meet with Professor Demiglas again, although no one really felt like going. It didn't help that the first thing he did was pass out a mentor sheet, updated with the tribute's names, saying, "This should facilitate keeping track of your progress in the games." 10th Hunger Games Mentor Assignments. District 1, Boy, Facet, Livia Cardew. Girl, Velverine, Palmyra Monti. District 2, Boy, Marcus, Sejanus Plinth. Girl, Sabin, Floris Friend. District 3, Boy, Cirque, Io Jasper. Girl, Tesley, Urban Canville. District 4, Boy, Mizzen, Persephone Price. Girl, Coral, Festus Creed. District 5, Boy, High, Dennis Fling. Girl, Soul, Iphigenia Moss. District 6, Boy, Otto, Apollo Ring. Girl, Ginny, Diana Ring. District 7, Boy, Treach, Vipsania Sickle. Girl, Lamina, Pliny Harrington. District 8, Boy, Bobbin, Juno Phipps. Girl, Wovey, Hilarius Heavensby. District 9, Boy, Panlo, Gaius Breen. Girl, Sheaf, Androcles Anderson. District 10, Boy, Tanner, Demetia Whimsywick. Girl, Brandy, Arachne Crane. District 11, Boy, Reaper, Clementia Dovecoat. Girl, Dill, Felix Ravenstill. District 12, Boy, Jessup, Lysistrata Vickers. Girl, Lucy Gray, Coriolanus Snow. Coriolanus, along with several people around him, automatically crossed off the name of the girl from District 10. But then what? It would make sense to cross off Arachne's name as well. But that felt different. His pen hovered over her name and then left it alone for the moment. It seemed pretty cold to scratch her off the list like that. About 10 minutes into class, a note arrived from the office instructing him and Clemencia to leave class and report immediately to the Citadel. This could only be in response to his proposal, and Coriolanus felt a combination of excitement and nervousness. Did Dr. Gall like it? Hate it? What did it mean? Since he hadn't bothered to tell her about his proposal, Clemencia was put out. "I can't believe you wrote up some proposal while Arachne's body was still warm. I cried all night long." Her puffy eyes backed up the claim. "Well, it's not like I could sleep either," Coriolanus objected. "After holding her while she died, working kept me from freaking out." "I know, I know. Everyone handles grief differently. I didn't mean that like it sounded," she sighed. "So what's in this thing I supposedly co-wrote?" Coriolanus gave her a quick overview, but she still seemed annoyed. "I'm sorry, I meant to tell you, it's pretty basic stuff, and some of it we already discussed as a group. Look, I already got one demerit this week. I can't afford to let my grades take a hit, too. Did you at least put my name on it? I don't want it to seem like I was too feeble to pull my weight," she said. "I didn't put anyone's name on it. It's more of a class project." Coriolanus threw up his hands in exasperation. "Honestly, Clemmy, I thought I was doing you a favor." "Okay, okay," she said, relenting. "I guess I owe you. But I wish I'd at least had a chance to read it. Just cover for me if she starts grilling us about it."